This is the Reading Instruction Show. I am your host, as always, the genial one, Dr. Andy Johnson. Topic of today's podcast, or the title, is called It's Easier to Blame Teachers Than to Fix Problems. Why spend money to fix a problem when you can simply blame teachers? Now, in 1997, Congress asked the director of the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development to work with the U.S. Secretary of Education, and their job was to establish a national reading panel. Duane Alexander, the director of the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development, was a medical doctor. Richard Riley, the Secretary of Education, had a degree in accounting. A physician and an accountant selected 14 people to serve on the National Reading Panel. And their task was to thoroughly review existing research and identify the most effective methods for teaching children to read. And they were given 18 months to do this. In 2000, the panel issued a 500-page comprehensive report titled Teaching Children to Read. And today it's known as the National Reading Panel Report. And this report is widely cited still by science of reading advocates. Now, the National Reading Panel Report had its limitations. For example, the report had significant statistical flaws in a variety of areas, and the research that was used, it was used selectively to favor very limited skills-based phonics-only reading programs. But the larger problem was the numbers. 2, 14, 18, and 110,000. Two government-appointed employees, a physician and an accountant, selected 14 people who were given 18 months to read over 110,000 research papers and come up with the one ultimate answer once and for all as to how best to teach reading. Now, I am no mathematician, but that certainly seems like bad arithmetic. Now, contrast this with the International Literacy Association and the National Council of Teachers of English. These are academic organizations consisting of thousands of teachers, researchers, scholars, parents, writers, publishers, and other professionals in areas related to literacy. In 2000, these organizations had been studying the best ways to teach reading for over 40 years, that's the International Literacy Association, and 90 years, the National Council of Teachers of English. Instead of utilizing the expertise, experience, and accumulated knowledge of these organizations, Dewey and Rick found 14 people to review 110 studies, selected studies in 18 months to come up with an answer. Imagine that. So many questions here. Why was there a need for a panel and government report? Who made this decision? Who decided that findings from the International Literacy Association and National Council of Teachers English were not acceptable? What data was used in deciding to form the panel? Were literacy researchers consulted? And who stood to gain from the report? Now, the National Reading Panel determined that early reading instruction should focus on five elements: phonemic awareness, phonics, vocabulary, comprehension, and fluency. And today, these are referred to as the five pillars of reading instruction. Despite having 18 whole months, the panel found nothing new here. In fact, in 2000, we already knew all about the five pillars. The five pillars have never been in question. The question has always been how pillar instruction should take place, how much pillar instruction should be given, how early, for how long, and for whom. The five pillars are neither necessary nor sufficient for learning to read. Instead, they are necessary for some in varying degrees, and they are not sufficient for any. Now, the biggest problem with the five pillars is that they're seven pillars short of a full load. Instead of five pillars, there should be 12 elements included in a comprehensive reading program. These elements should be addressed as needed and not given to all children in a predetermined sequence. As children develop as readers, some elements are diminished and eventually discounted. What are the 12 elements? Phonemic awareness, phonics, vocabulary, comprehension, and fluency. Those are the big five. Word recognition, word identification, reading practice, conversations and social interaction, authentic writing experiences, affect, which is motivation and emotion, and social cultural background. You're welcome. Well, then came No Child Left Behind. This was passed in Congress with overwhelming bipartisan support in 2001 and signed into law by President George W. Bush in 2002. However, there were no real educational innovations in No Child Left Behind, simply more tests and an increased pressure to privatize education. No Child Left Behind did nothing to change the process of how we went about educating our children. Instead, it simply called for more standardized tests with penalties for schools that did poorly. This hyper-testing was done despite a wealth of rigorous scientific evidence that said that this was bad practice. No Child Left Behind mistook measuring schools for fixing them. The untested hypothesis behind No Child Left Behind was that all the successful schools, as determined by high test scores, would grow and prosper, while all the underachieving schools, as determined by low test scores, would disappear someplace. The quote, reasoning, unquote, was that this system of competition seemed to work well with shopping centers and fast food restaurants and convenience stores. So it stood to reason that it must work equally well with schools. Free market pressures were seen as the answer to all of life's complex problems. A free market economy is based on competition. Supply and demand regulate production and labor. Companies sell goods and services at the highest price consumers are willing to pay, while workers earn the highest wages companies are willing to pay for their services. Here, the successful flourish while the unsuccessful fade away. While this paradigm may work in the business world, where profits are the bottom line, it does not transfer to education, where people are the bottom line. No Child Left Behind failed to improve the education system for schools, teachers, students, and families. But that shouldn't have been a big surprise. This is the sort of thing we expect when people outside of education make decisions about education. In 2015, No Child Left Behind was replaced by the Every Student Succeeds Act, a more flexible but equally ineffective version of No Child Left Behind. Which brings us to the science of reading today. In preparing this podcast, I was reading an article describing the media's portrayal of education and the No Child Left Behind era, written in 2008. I could have easily substituted Science of Reason Reading 2024 for No Child Left Behind 2001. Four common themes appearing in the media back then seem not to have gone away. They are these. One, there's a reading crisis. There's a crisis in education. Two, teachers currently can't do their jobs and we should be afraid. Three, teacher quality can be defined as curriculum delivery and measured by test performance. And four, high quality teaching will reduce society problems. But you see, it's all a bit of sleight of hand that diverts the eyes from the real causes of educational failure. If you can blame students, teachers, and colleges of education, we won't see the social problems that impact learning. It's much easier to blame teachers than to fix the actual cause of social problems. However, there is one thing which we can all be certain, and this is it. Take this one to the bank. If Cengage Learning, Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, McGraw-Hill Education, Pearson Education, and Scholastic could sell products to fix one of these other social problems, that would be the cause of the next educational crisis. This has been the Reading Instruction Show. I'm your host, Dr. Andy Johnson.